From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up,
this is not a good day for the fishing industry.
New England fishermen react to the creation of an Atlantic Marine Monument, an executive order President Obama calls critical to marine preservation.
The notion that the ocean I grew up with is not something that I can pass on to my kids and my grandkids is unacceptable.
We'll talk about that and the rest of the week's stories with our Week in Review panel. Also today, the Massachusetts architect behind the country's largest memorial to victims of lynching.
Germany and South Africa, and of course Rwanda, have found it necessary to build memorials to reflect on the atrocities of their past in order to heal their national psyche. We have yet to do this.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, so that means time for the Week in Review. Beginning with the big announcement by President Obama yesterday, creating the Atlantic Ocean's first national marine monument.
Our oceans feed us, protect us, regulate our climate, our weather, anchors industries from transportation to tourism to trade of all kind. The health of our planet's oceans determine in large part the health of our own bodies and the health of our economies.
Again, that's President Obama announcing the creation of the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument, the first such marine monument in American Atlantic waters. It sits 130 miles off Cape Cod, is the size of Connecticut, an aquatic treasure worthy of protection, according to Tim Schenck with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
They have live corals and fish, a variety of ecosystems, sponge ecosystems, that are often found nowhere else on Earth. And these seamounts are very important scientifically because we believe there's places where new species form.
But the president's executive action means an end to fishing in the newly created monument. So here's Beth Cassoni with the Massachusetts Lobstermen Association.
If you want to save a piece of coral, people will throw tens of thousands of dollars at it. But if you want to save a fisherman, they'll tell him to get another job. And it's not that easy. There's a reason why people fish. They love it. It's a way of life. It's ingrained in their souls. And, you know, it's not that easy just to tell a fisherman to go get another job.
Well, joining us now to discuss this and the rest of the week's news is Charlie Chipio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and a research fellow at the Ash Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Charlie Chipio, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Also with us today, Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Hi there, Shira.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a long week. I'm sorry. I'm tripping over all over my own words today. So let me just turn it over to the two of you. First, thoughts on the creation of this new marine monument. Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, you know, I can't claim to be an expert on marine monuments and these kind of things, but I think that a couple things kind of really interest me about this. You know, one is this whole issue that it raises about the fishing industry. And I kind of wonder, to some degree, if the fishing industry at this point is really salvageable around here. You know, it seems like we've overfished for so long, and then you add in climate change and those kind of issues. And you know, I wonder, you know, if this is something that we can fix at this point. And I guess the other thing that comes to mind is that it's the latest example of this kind of dysfunction we have in Washington, where President Obama did this under this 1906 Antiquities Act, mm-hmm. executive order power, and some are saying it circumvents this 1970s legislation about how we regulate fisheries. And to me, it just seems to be the latest example of the dysfunction down there.
Okay, so Shira, your thoughts?
Well, I agree with Charlie with regard to the questioning the salvageability of the fishing industry in New England. I think there's some, you know, I just wonder if we've passed the point of no return yeah. at this juncture. However, I don't agree with you, Charlie, with regard to the dysfunction in Washington. I think that Obama actually had to do this and do this with a sense of urgency because you don't know what's going to happen in November. And we seem to have pushed these conservation efforts off for so long that we're now digging ourselves out of a hole with regard to conservation, particularly with ocean conservation. And there, again, with ocean conservation, there also reaches a point of no return. You've done so much damage to an area that it can't be rehabbed and it can't come back to life, particularly with these corals. And what I see with this reserve here, this preserve, this marine monument, and what I understand about it is there's some really, really unique features mm-hmm. there. There are canyons that are deeper than the Grand Canyon. There are mountains, underwater mountains, that are the highest mountains east of the Rockies. And there is this coral life that is very rich and diverse, and that if you have people in there fishing, you risk destroying it. And I think you have to take these steps. You have to take bold action. And sometimes you have to take quick action, maybe under the cover of mm-hmm. darkness, so to speak, mm-hmm. to get it done. Because if you push it off, then you'll do damage that's irreversible.
Charlie, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, well, a couple of things. One, my in terms of fishery, that comes from grave, you know, extensive personal experience in going out there and not catching anything. So that's what
grave
I know about
experience.
That. Yes. I mean, I'm not saying he was wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that you know, in a perfect world, this would have been done through a different process. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that I think he was wrong to do it. I'm just saying it's the latest piece of evidence in terms of the way things work down there.
Okay.
Don't work down
well,
there.
Let me just play a little bit of tape here. It's a little tough to hear, but it's worth sort of craning your neck to listen, because we spoke with John Williams. He's the president of the Atlantic Red Crab Company. He's a red crab fisherman. Now, they get 7 years before they have to stop fishing there, but he was actually at sea on his fishing boat talking to us over a satellite phone when we spoke with him yesterday, and here's what he said.
I would prefer that the process went through the public process the way that all other fishing management did. This is not a good day for the fishing industry.
So, Shira, let me turn that back to you, because this idea that President Obama used an executive order rather than going through the public process, we've heard that from a lot of other folks in Massachusetts. Not that long ago, we spoke with the mayor of New Bedford, who said exactly this. And it's an issue, apparently. I mean, according to John Williams, all other fishing management does go through this public process.
Agreed. I mean, it is an issue, and it's unseemly on the surface. And I think they have a valid point. You know, it's troublesome in some ways that it went through this executive order. And, you know, admittedly, there are processes in place. There have been, you know, efforts to sort of balance conservation efforts with commercial fishing. However, it seems to me from all that I've read about the fishing, these efforts take an incredibly long time. And they're dependent oftentimes on what the national administration, what the configuration of that is, Republican versus Democrat, people who believe in climate change versus people who don't believe in climate change in power. And so I think the great fear is that if you put this off and open this up to the public process, this is 10, maybe 15, maybe 20 years down the road, and you're not saving this. It's already gone.
We don't have that long. Yeah.
You don't have that long. And also, let's be honest, there were some compromises made. This was a much larger area mm-hmm. originally. The Connecticut Congressional Delegation wanted a much larger area covered, and they reduced that. And also, I believe it's lobster and red crab fishermen have that 7-year
right.
grace period so to make adjustments. Now, I know it's going to be hard to find other areas to fish, and everything is a bit overcrowded with regard to fishing areas, but I think there was some good faith effort on the part of, you know, Obama and his administration to make the transition as painless as possible.
Right. Well, Charlie, I'm going to turn back to you in a second, but I want to play sort of the other side of that coin, because yesterday we also spoke with Tim Schenck. He's from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and he actually talked to us about how the creation of this marine monument may actually help fish stocks.
We need them for fisheries. We have juvenile fish, a variety of species that use these corals as their sanctuaries, as their hatcheries. So scientifically, they're very important to us, and we don't understand much about them. We've only been studying these canyon areas for the last 5 years.
So, Charlie, you can share your thoughts about that with us. But I'm also wondering, since suddenly it popped in my mind, since this is an executive order, this could get turned around in November anyway, right?
Yeah, it could. I think it's one of these questions where how far along is it? You know, does it become unrealistic to stop it? But, I can understand why, you know, why he would do this. And logically, I'm no expert on the fishery, but it does make sense that if the more you protect it, the more you have an opportunity for these fish to sort of come to maturity and develop and maybe for the stocks to increase. I mean, it seems to me that that's been the problem up until now, the political inability to say, hey, look, you know, we've got to really cut down on this or else it's never coming back.
Yeah.
But that's a hard thing to implement.
You know, it was interesting that this is a decision that has made some strange bedfellows. We noticed that both Governor Charlie Baker and Senator Elizabeth Warren expressed some concerns about the creation of the monument. Charlie Baker said in a statement that his administration is deeply disappointed by the federal government's unilateral decision to undermine the Commonwealth's commercial and recreational fishermen. And Senator Warren said in a statement, the ocean and seafood industry are critical parts of our coastal economy. I'm disappointed that this process ultimately culminated without broad stakeholder consensus. Shira?
They have their right to their opinions. But I keep coming back to the same argument, which is these types of decisions are taking at this point, we're at a critical juncture. And if we don't act now, it's going to be too late. And, you know, and there's so much uncertainty about the politics around this. I think Obama felt that sense of urgency. And, you know, as he said in his remarks, I mean, the ocean impacts everything. It impacts the economy in ways besides fisheries.
It impacts
the climate, the health of our bodies.
It is the climate regulator.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is the climate regulator. And this particular area, it's worth mentioning, I believe, is increasing. The temperature of the water there because of climate change is increasing three times faster than other ocean areas. So this is a really, really critical area that is under siege and changing faster than other parts of the ocean. So it seems like this was almost an emergency situation that they were dealing with as opposed to other ocean areas.
It's interesting at the end of a presidential term, too, sometimes you can find out things what really matters to these folks. You know, it's
this legacy.
Comes on, you know, and this comes on the heels of doing a similar thing in the waters off Hawaii.
And that one's much larger.
Much larger. Clearly, he sees this as a high priority.
Well, this is a guy who grew up in Hawaii, you know, body surfing off the waters of Hawaii. So clearly the ocean has a personal pull for him.
And I think the only other thing I would add is, you know, I understand what Senator Warren said about consensus, but you know what? You're never going to have consensus.
You're going to either have the environmentalists and the activists angered, or you're going to have the fishermen angered. And I think they, like I said, in good faith, tried to reach some sort of compromise with a smaller area in the 7-year, transition period for lobstermen and red crab fishermen. But like you say, Charlie, there's never going to be consensus with an issue like this.
Well, let's move on to another story from this week's news. And that has to do with more terrestrial concerns, if I can put it that way. On the streets of Boston this week, Boston police finally launched their body camera pilot program. And again, just background here, Boston Police Union had agreed to participate in the program, but then it was supposed to be voluntary and urged officers not to volunteer to wear the body cams. Last Friday, a Superior Court judge ruled that the police commissioner does have the authority to assign officers to the program. So that meant that this week, on Monday, 107 Boston police officers started wearing the cameras. And on Wednesday, we spoke with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, and here's what he said.
There is definitely tension out there in the communities, in certain neighborhoods. Body cameras can't build trust in a community. They're there to take a film, an interaction. What builds trust in a community is actually interaction with the community, with what young people in the office, in the community. That's what we need, the officers in the community to interact.
So, Charlie, what's your thoughts that this pilot program has finally gotten off the ground?
Well, just that it should have gotten off the ground a long time ago. Look, we live in an environment where we've had too many examples in the last 2 years of particularly African-American males getting shot in the back for reasons that are tenuous at best. And if we're going to have faith and we're going to have a system that works between police and the public at large, we're going to have to do things that increase trust between those two entities. And I think something like this is the kind of basic thing that we have to do. The research shows that cameras tend to reduce complaints against police. And I guess my only question, the one thing that I sort of wonder about this, and this is a very simple question, which is that the idea is that they're supposed to sort of switch this on whenever they have any interaction. Well, I can see a lot of, oops, I forgot to switch this on, you know, and I wonder sort of what the response to that's going to be. How are
well,
we going to deal
with that? I think that's the beauty, though, of the pilot program, which is they have these 100 officers.
Right.
It's 6 months. And listen, I think they did a good job. They have a diversity of officers. I believe they come from the five sections of the city, plus the youth violence strike force.
Yep.
They're black officers, white officers, Latino, Asian officers, 87 men out of the 100 chosen to wear the cameras. So I think, you know, they're going to have a wide sampling. I think that's the beauty of a pilot program. You get to see and study, okay, where did this policy fall short?
You get to work the kinks out,
exactly. And this, you know, and I think that's what will happen. Well, they'll start to see, okay, so when they're pulling over drivers, maybe they're not turning on, you know, we may need to put a time period, you know, when you're approaching the car, that's when you turn the camera on. I think they'll be able to, you know, iron out the kinks, as you say.
You know, one thing that keeps staying with me is that, you know, what impact this long fight has or had on community relations between BPD and the people of Boston. And in fact, on Tuesday, Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans spoke to Channel 2, and he said this about the fact that, you know, a lawsuit had to or they had to overcome a lawsuit in order to get this pilot program off the ground.
It sent the message that we're hiding something. And, you know, in the longer we were fighting it, the more people think that, you know, we're doing some bad things out there. And I tried to say, we're not perfect, but I think we're doing great.
Again, the lawsuit came from the police unions. But Charlie and Shira, I wonder what you think about that, because whether or not it's true, Commissioner Evans himself is saying it sent the wrong message, this long fight.
And he's right. And, you know, look, I think it's in, you know, if you look, take a bigger look at this from sort of 30,000 feet. Look, the reality is that, as he said, Boston is certainly not perfect. But boy, if it's like this in Boston, and the situation between the community and the police is way better in Boston than it is in Baltimore or Baton Rouge or a whole lot of other cities in the United States. And I think it really speaks to the challenge that we face with this issue.
Yeah and I can understand, I mean, or you can try to understand, you know, what the police union president, Patrick Rose, was thinking. Basically, he was saying, you know, we had this agreement in place. It was going to be volunteers, and it was a signed agreement. So if you breach this signed agreement, what's to keep you? He saw a slippery slope there, and that was his argument and the argument they had during the hearing. And I can see where, if you're a union head, that would be something you would grip onto. But I do think it does, you know, create a bad image that you are hiding something, or that you don't want to do this type of policing, or that you don't want to use all the tools that might be at your disposal.
I mean, that image, in a way, I have to say, is partially true, because the union itself that directed its members not to volunteer.
Who breached it? And I think, you know, the union and police officers are going to have to come to the realization that this is 21st century policing. When you have technology available, whether it's body cameras or data that can help you, better analyze crime statistics and better deploy your forces, you are going to be asked to use the technology, whatever it is. And they're going to have, I mean, change is tough, but this is where we are in the 21st century. We have this technology available. We have these incidences of police shootings that you know are under sometimes mysterious or kind of questionable circumstances, and this is where we are at this juncture, and you have to kind of get on board at this point.
Well, there's another story that I want to touch on, because it's a national story, but it actually did touch down locally here in the past week, and that has to do with NFL players protesting during the national anthem. Now, a number of athletes just this past weekend joined San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. He has been the one leading a protest of racial inequality and police brutality by not standing during the playing of the national anthem. Now, the players who have recently joined him in doing something similar, Pats players Martellus Bennett and Devin McCourty. Now, they both raised their fists at the end of the anthem before the Pats' Sunday night game in Arizona. Here's Bennett speaking to Comcast Sportsnet in the locker room after the game.
One of those things, let them know that this is something that we care about. This is something that we want to bring change in a positive way. We're not trying to be a distraction. We're just working to be a positive influence in our community. And I have friends who've been unjustly discriminated against, or, you know, all those things. And it's not just, you know, black, white thing. It's for all people. You know, it's just, we want everybody to be treated fairly and just.
And it's not just happening at NFL games. Here in Massachusetts, at a Worcester High School football player, Michael Opong, knelt during a recent game. And here's what he told WBUR.
Black people don't get a lot of equality and are judged more by the color of their skin. than their actions. And the national anthem is supposed to be a celebration of our rights as Americans. And if I'm not getting my rights, then I don't feel like I should be celebrating the national anthem.
So, Shira, let's start with you on this. I mean, athletes always run the risk of being told politics don't have any place on the field. And yet here we have, you know, pros all the way down to a high school player starting to say, no, there is a place for politics on the field.
And I say good for them. I'm actually happy to see athletes taking a more activist stance when it comes to issues of social injustice. I think it's about time. You know, there was this great period in the 1960s when you had John Carlos and Tommy Smith, who you remember from the 1968 Olympics, raising their fists on the medal stand.
I do. You two are too young.
Okay. A collective memory. And, you know, you had Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Jim Brown, even locally here, Bill Russell talking about social injustice. And then there was this period, I think, you know, where athletes started to get more money and endorsement deals where they feared losing that.
Right.
And they
The Michael Jordan syndrome,
the Tiger Woods syndrome,
but
even
rightly
that.
Rightly fearing, because there have always been consequences
exactly.
for players who speak out.
Exactly. But I think we've reached a new period. I think it may have started a few years ago when LeBron James made a stand and all the Miami Heat put on their hoodies as sort of a tribute to Trayvon Martin. So I think there's been a growing tide of social protests, which I'm happy to see as long as the athletes do it thoughtfully, because I think their run the risk that you have sort of a Curt Schilling, let's say, type figure who uses his sports celebrity as a platform to try, you know, to espouse ideas that controversial ideas and sort of say, this is the way it should be. My ideas are right.
But why not, though? I mean, if Colin Kaepernick can espouse ideas that some people also find equally troubling, why not have, you know, more conservative athletes do the same?
I draw a distinction between what Colin Kaepernick is doing and what, you know, the Worcester High School football player. They're at least they say they're trying to raise awareness and start a discussion. I don't think Curt Schilling is particularly interested in starting a discussion. He's interested in hearing himself talk.
I want to come back to you on this, but Charlie, let me get your thought.
Well, look, I think that this and the body cameras, I like to think I have a nuanced view of these things, but I think these are two that are just clear cut. You know, these guys have a right to express their opinions and to, you know, express their views in a free country. And the reality is that, yeah, I very much prefer the way that Kaepernick has done this and the way that Michael Oppong has done this to what Curt Schilling has done. But Curt Schilling has the right to do it his thing, too. You know, the reality is, you know, that these guys have not done anything wrong. I mean, they haven't disrupted anything. They're just expressing their opinions, and especially the kid from Worcester. I got to tell you,
that takes courage.
Yeah,
to be a high school kid and do that.
As a parent, you know, the view I've come to have is I don't really care if so much if I agree with the positions my kids take. What I want them to be able to do is to be able to tell me why they're doing it and express their opinions clearly. And he's been able to do that.
Yeah, to think
great.
About it, to be passionate
right.
about it,
exactly.
to have a cause, to be committed to a purpose. I think those are important lessons, particularly for high school kids.
And because they risk so much going forward also.
Yeah.
But, you know, Shira, I've been reading that some folks are saying that Colin Kaepernick right now is the most hated man in the NFL.
Yeah, but his jersey sales are number one. So I don't know how you measure hate. With respect to that, you know, I think there are probably some team executives and team owners and NFL executives that wish he wouldn't be taking the stand and wish that the stand hadn't grown into a larger movement across the NFL. But I question whether he's the most hated man in the NFL.
Well,
I think that's a little bit strong. Yeah. And I think that just by the
it's Roger
evidence.
Goodell.
I was going to say, yes, it's Roger Goodell. Number one, I think he has a strong case there. But I just think that judging by the way the movement has spread to other teams and other players, and not only other teams and other players, but other sports. I mean, there's a woman, Megan Rapinoe, who is with the women's national soccer
right.
team, who's also protesting.
Right.
So this is not just
and
limited.
She's white.
And she's white.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is not just about football. And I think to say that he's the most hated man in the NFL and to see the movement it started is false.
The thing I wonder is sort of sports fan to sports fan.
Yes.
Charlie. Would he have done this when he was a couple of years ago when he was a starting quarterback and an all-pro? You know, interesting that I'm not knocking
you know
him, but
what?
It's just interesting that he's doing it now that he's
well, I think he's
a
doing it now. One, I think he probably would have. And, you know, there are major name, big name players who are starters who are doing this. So I don't think that, you know, I think what's happened is he's seen more incidents.
Yeah.
And I think you reach a point of frustration,
yeah.
and that comes with age and experience. I mean, don't forget a few years ago when he was starting and all
a lot
pro,
of this stuff hadn't happened.
A lot of this stuff hadn't happened, and he was young.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see a lot of the older players doing this because they know and they experience, and they also feel a little bit more comfortable in their mm-hmm. skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's one last question I want to ask you guys before we move to our hubbubs, and that is that a couple weeks ago I heard Kareem Abdul-Jabbar give an interview on NPR, and he was talking about, you know, Muhammad Ali and his own acts of political speech and the consequences they had. And he was asked, well, did it make a difference ultimately in terms of the cause that you were speaking out about? And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said yes, because it raised awareness. I mean, is that enough?
I think it is. I really think it is. I think to get people talking about, I mean, listen, they talk when these shootings happen and then it sort of dies down and you hear nothing about it, or maybe, you know, there's a news report here or there. But this has been ever since Colin Kaepernick kneeled down in his first, I guess it was a preseason game, you know, a few weeks ago, ever since that happened, there's been a pretty constant conversation about not only the protest, but a little about what they're protesting for. So I
yeah.
think raising awareness, because sometimes that awareness, you know, creates change. It's not instantaneous. It may be a year or
yes.
two or three from years from now, but I think just the momentum starts building,
yeah.
and that's
and
what you have
I
here.
I think it's easy to say that, to ask that question, if you don't necessarily remember those times. And I think somebody like my dad, who was not a hater by any stretch, a wonderful, loving guy, and I just remember how enraged he was by Muhammad Ali in 1970. And that was just so typical
mm-hmm.
of people back then. And that whole attitude has dramatically shifted
yeah.
over these 40
years. You know, I've got to just jump in here, Shira, because our producers are looking at me. And they're like, if we only had a 24-second shot clock out here to
we
move
need
the
one.
Conversation along, because we really are running down on time. Good conversation, though. But let's just sneak in our hubbubs, if we can, in the last couple seconds that we have here. And Shira, I'm going to start with you.
All right. Well, I will start with the researchers at MIT. They have come up with something better than X-ray vision, at least where ancient books are concerned. So using terahertz radiation technology, they've figured out a way to read books through their covers. Now, you're asking, how does this work? Well, a terahertz camera shoots pulses of radiation at an old book, one with pages that would likely crumble mm-hmm. if you open them. And then the researchers measure how long it takes for the pulses to bounce back. Those measurements are fed through a letter recognition algorithm. By the way, this is way above my head technologically. That algorithm was developed by the folks at Georgia Tech. And voila, you get a reproduction of the text on the pages inside the book.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
I think this is
wow.
it's great
yeah.
news
no,
for historians
great.
And for people who want to delve into these ancient books, but they can't. It's too dangerous, at least from a crumbling standpoint.
So this
standpoint.
Means that when my kids are sitting there staring at the book, they can now actually tell me that they're reading
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly. That's what's coming. That's 2 or 3 years down the road. And then it will be osmosis, Charlie. You don't even have
right.
to have, you know.
I remember that technology
the book in
from
front
when
of
I was
them.
A kid. Charlie, you're hubbub.
Well, being back here on the BU campus where I went to college, it got me thinking about this upcoming marijuana ballot initiative this November.
I'm saying we need more time.
But you know, the recent poll showed that the yes votes on this to legalize marijuana are likely ahead. A BUR poll actually, and it was interesting. I read in the Boston Herald the other day that Stephanie Pollack, who's the state secretary for transportation, one of her top priorities, she said, is if this passes, she is going to develop the equivalent of a breathalyzer test to determine if people are driving under the influence of marijuana. So all those who are anticipating, you know, this the legalizing marijuana, it's like that old Talking Head song, watch out, you might get what you're after.
She's got a fight on her hands about that, because there's a lot of dispute about whether you can accurately measure and whether different people are,
metabolize it differently
and what effects it has on their driving.
Another indication that there are so many levels to all these questions, right? And that's the latest.
Never an easy issue.
All right.
Public policy.
So before I give you my hubbub, I just want to actually throw out a reminder to listeners about something else entirely, because we're doing this series of debates over the four ballot questions. questions voters will be facing in November. Last week, we had a very spirited one about question two and charter schools. This coming Tuesday, it'll be the second in our debate series, and we're going to be tackling question three. That's the one that proposes to limit confinement of some farm animals, egg-laying hens and breeding pigs, for example. And for anyone listening, if you want to attend the debate, they're great fun. They're at UMass Boston. Go to wbur.org/events and register now, and you can get some tickets there. And of course, you can always listen live Tuesday at 3 o'clock.
And I was at the last one. You should go. They're great.
Well,
very interesting.
See, we got support right here from Charlie. Okay, so that was my little plug for our debate series. My hubbub actually has to do with a concert that I wish I had gone to this week. Adele.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, I mean, apparently it was.
I thought you were going to say Springsteen.
No. I think we're the Adele crowd. It was a great concert. Apparently, all the reporting and reading I've done about it said she did a wonderful job. But my hubbub has to do with the fact that she gave a shout out to a local donut maker, to Blackbird Donuts. And apparently Adele really loves their Boston Cream Bismarck donuts. And good for them. They were besieged by customers the day after the concert looking for Adele-approved items, and they had given some to her. So good shout out for Blackbird. And now I have to say, I've tried their donuts, but I've never tried the Boston Cream Bismarck. Have you guys?
I have not.
Better get there. They said they ran out by 9 o'clock in the morning.
They did. I know.
Morning.
I wonder when sales are going to slow down.
I want to try that, and then I want to have her here for carpool karaoke.
Well, you better get it quick.
You and James Corden.
She says she's not going to tour for a while now to raise her son, right?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so.
Okay, well, on that note, then let's just close with a little Adele. Well, Charlie Chipio is head of Chipio Strategies and a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and also a research fellow at the Kennedy School of Government. Charlie, have a great weekend. Thanks so much.
You too. Thank you.
And Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Always great to have you, Shira. Thanks
Likewise.
So much.
Likewise. Donuts and Adele on my list.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A tiny sparrow lives in salt marshes from Maine to Virginia, and it could be the new poster child for our changing coastal habitat. Experts say rising sea levels make the little bird's future uncertain, and it may spell the first sign of danger to an entire ecosystem. Davis Donovan of the New England News Collaborative reports.
A salt marsh isn't very homey. There are no trees, and the short, stubbly bushes don't offer much cover from predators like hawks for a small bird like the salt marsh sparrow. Plus, everything's covered in salty seawater.
Flooding is an essential part of marshes. It's just, a way of life daily.
University of Connecticut graduate student Samantha Apgar trudges through a salt marsh at Connecticut's Hammonasset State Park. Every step could be dry ground or a mud puddle that sucks you in up to your knees.
Oop, and I'm falling in.
Apgar steadies herself and says this isn't an easy place for any animal.
Which is why there are only a couple of specialist species that live and breed and spend most of their life cycles in this ecosystem.
The salt marsh sparrow is one of them because it keeps to the ground. It's lightweight and scurries around on big feet that keep it from sinking in the mud. And it's not easy to spot.
Sometimes they will come up, too, when you just go.
Patrick Cummins with Audubon, Connecticut, tries to lure one out for a good look. A bird pops up from the bushes, then quickly pops back down again.
Yep. That was a salt marsh, I bet. We don't know why they pop up when you do that, but they do.
He says the bird rarely flies any higher than the top branches.
If you see a small sparrow just pop up out of the salt marsh, fly a little ways, and drop back down again, it's probably a salt marsh sparrow.
And that keep-your-head-down strategy is what puts salt marsh sparrows at risk, because they build their nests on the ground. Samantha Apgar says they only have a small window of time to get their eggs hatched and their chicks out of the nest before the tide comes in and washes them away.
As the tides, high tides creep on each end of that short window, there really won't be a time for them to fledge these chicks. So it's really spelling disaster for the species.
Apgar, along with University of Connecticut biologist Chris Elphick, looked at how sea level rise will affect the salt marshes over the next century. Elphick says the salt marsh sparrow may not have more than 50 years to survive in its habitat, but the little bird is only the first sign of trouble.
It acts kind of like the proverbial canary in the coal mine in that it's an indicator of what's going to happen to the rest of the system, all of the other species.
That includes at least four other birds that live in the marsh, like the seaside sparrow and the clapper rail. And there will be nowhere left for them to go because much of the land here along the coast has been developed. There are a few suggestions being bantered about on how to provide a place for the bird to lay their eggs, but none of them are simple. For instance, artificial islands that would float in the tide like tiny arcs.
That report from Davis Donovan from the New England News Collaborative. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Michael Murphy is an architect and the executive director of the Boston-based Mass Design Group. Murphy has done work around the world, but a while ago, he read an article about a man named Brian Stevenson, and that launched Murphy on one of the most ambitious American projects he's undertaken so far. You see, Brian Stevenson is founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, and he wants to create a national memorial to the victims of lynching. Stevenson described why in an interview on CBS.
The smog created by that history of racial inequality continues to compromise our health. And there's no place in this country where you can go and have an honest experience with the history of
lynching. And why? Do you think it's because it's too painful?
I think it's because we have created a narrative of denial. We think if we own up to our mistakes, something bad is going to happen to us, we're going to get punished. And I'm not doing these projects because I want to punish America. I want us to be liberated from the chains that this history has created.
Now, the very way that Brian Stevenson talks about the idea of a lynching memorial, that not having one contributes to the persistent national trauma of racial injustice, well, that spoke deeply to architect Michael Murphy. Just listen to how Murphy himself describes the fundamental purpose of great architecture in a TED Talk earlier this year.
Great architecture can give us hope. Great architecture can heal.
Well, the National Memorial to the Victims of Lynching is set to open in Montgomery, Alabama next year. And Michael Murphy and Mass Design Group designed it. Michael Murphy joins us now. He's in New York today. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
It's great to have you. And let me just first ask you, what does it mean that when you first met with Brian Stevenson, you ended up forming the kind of relationship where you and Mass Design Group are the designers of this memorial?
Well, I think Brian, like many others, are out there seeking a way for architecture to really inform their mission, to improve their overall outcomes as an organization. And he, like I had found as well, traveling through Rwanda or Germany, had seen the vast number of efforts that countries had gone through to invest in memorials and markers that would reflect on the nation's horrific pasts or past atrocities in order to heal their national psyches. And he thought, you know, we have yet to do this in the United States.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I understand that you had read about him and then basically just sent him an email out of the blue. I was wondering what it is about this project in particular that you wanted to be, that made you wanted to be a part of it.
We at Mass Design Group are focused on finding ways in which architecture and design can really improve our lives as individuals and also see where we can help communities and individuals heal. We like to use the word heal. Using architecture as a mechanism for social change. We really began this organization as students in Boston at the Graduate School of Design at Harvard and had been introduced to the great healthcare leader Paul Farmer and his work in Rwanda. And he had said, where are architects that can help us do these projects that we're serving communities in great need? Why are there so many brilliant architects in this city doing incredible creative projects, but very few of them are serving the communities that need it the most? And this put us on a journey to really find why that was and also to ask, what more can we do as architects? What else can we as designers be focusing our attention on and investing in projects that would fundamentally have change as its mission.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk with you more in just a minute about this idea of architecture as a healing force. But describe to us what you can about the design of the lynching memorial that you hope would invoke that healing.
Well, memorial design is a challenging and controversial thing these days, and many scholars talk about it, about the best way to think about memorialization. Is it a static or is it a dynamic thing? Is it temporary? Is it something very permanent? And the notion of building a movement of truth and reconciliation in this country and to mark the places where African Americans were lynched throughout America it's not a static project. It's a multi-year initiative, and Brian saw this as an era of truth and reconciliation, which he spoke to us about, and that really informed the design of the memorial. We thought not about just having a statue or a place to visit that would stay the same, but one that would change over time, and that very DNA of having markers that could be removed from the site and placed in other counties throughout the country where these killings occurred allowed us to create a memorial that was active, one that would engage the communities where these atrocities had occurred, would bring people together like a barn raising or like an active participatory process to really build this movement of truth and reconciliation that we seek.
Well, you know, people can see a little glimpse of the memorial design in a TED Talk that you gave earlier this year, but it was just released online yesterday, and we have a link to that at radioboston.org. It is a very, even just seeing it in the sort of digital walkthrough that you presented in your TED Talk, it's quite emotional. And again, we'll have a link to that at radioboston.org. But Michael, I was wondering if we could just take a step back and sort of explore in a little bit more depth and detail this idea of architecture as a healing force, because right there on the Mass Design website, on your group's website, there's this very bold statement that you say that architecture is never neutral. It either heals or hurts. Now, for the places that are deliberately designed to promote some kind of national or even individual healing, I get that. But are you saying that all other architecture, most other architecture damages us in some way?
It's a provocative statement, but I do fully believe it, that architecture is not simply an object. It's not simply a sculpture that we use or inhabit. It shapes our daily lives. We live in buildings 90% of our lives, and it shapes our behavior. We really learned this, especially working in places like Rwanda or Haiti with amazing doctors. And the design of medical facilities is a particularly acute example of where spaces shape behavior. They shape health outcomes. If you look at prisons, there are many, many examples of where the space itself is causing people to suffer. And here are very, very direct examples of where architecture can be violent and injurious and hurt people. So we must ask, how can it be beneficial? How can it foster healing? How can it be proactive? And think about positive behavioral change. Mm. This is a provocative idea in that, you know, some want to believe that architecture is just a luxury, that those who can afford it use it and benefit from it. But if we do see our built world as a place that is shaping our everyday lives in major and micro ways, then we are introducing architecture more as a behavioral science and as well as an art form, something that we can work together with to improve our lives on a daily basis and also calculate and measure how it is doing so.
Yeah, you know, I think I have been in spaces beforehand where I have felt uplifted by the design of the space. There's something about it that definitely, you know, sort of moves you. But you're also talking about like literal healing in a certain sense. I mean, some of the work that you were talking about in Rwanda that you've done with the hospitals did exactly that. Could you give us just an example or two of some design elements that you put in your work in Africa that promotes healing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see this notion of healing in different scales. I mean, there's definitely the healing of the body, how one uses a space and how it can affect your physical health. In Rwanda, we were encountered hospitals where the designs of patient rooms had not been thought about. The designs of hallways and waiting areas had not really been thought about. And in a particular hospital that Dr. Farmer introduced me to in South Africa, patients walked into a hallway where other patients were sitting with multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis and airborne disease. And those same patients coughed on each other and cultivated this disease in that space, and many of them were immunosuppressed. And then they left the hospital with an extremely drug-resistant strand of TB. Simple designs for infection control were not thought about, and people died because of it. This is a crisis, right? This is where it's not only space, but it is certainly an element of the total package of what's causing this disease to be incubated and transferred and then to actually kill people. The director of the hospital said people died because this space was not designed correctly. Mm. And so you have examples of that there, and we want to ask, well, what are the examples we can design that would not only resist those potential disease transfers, but help to foster healthy living?
Well, you know, you've taken this idea of architecture as a potential healing force and turned it into almost an entire philosophy, right, of the built world. In your TED Talk, you presented it as the low-fab philosophy. Explain what low-fab is to us.
Yeah, thanks for asking that. Low-fab stands for locally fabricated. And I was conflicted when I was asked to work in Port-au-Prince, Haiti after the earthquake with an amazing organization called Jeskio by the amazing doctor, Dr. Bill Pop. And he had asked us to help design a tuberculosis hospital that had fallen down in the earthquake and rebuild it with the same research that we had done in Rwanda. And so many architects came out to support the work in Haiti. There was a real sense that we had to do something about it. Many famous architects went to Haiti to work. Many studios and different schools said, we're responsible for this. It was the buildings that killed so many people. It fell on people after the earthquake, not the earthquake itself, which killed people, but buildings that fell on people after the earthquake. And so there was some accountability. And yet the solutions were limited. So many solutions were prefabricated. If we flat pack houses and send them over to Haiti and erect them very quickly, this could be a solution for the housing crisis. And one of the things that we had learned working with Dr. Farmer was that it wasn't just the quick construction of buildings, it was the process of building that was so healing, that could foster change. And they taught us in Rwanda so much about the labor quotient of building, that we had to employ as many people locally as possible and leverage local artisans in order to build this thing with our hands.
Right.
And so that really changed the way I thought about the solution. Quick and prefabricated housing solves one problem, the lack of housing, but it doesn't solve the other problem, which is fostering a community health, building, giving people jobs and investing in the local labor and local materials that's available there.
Well, Michael, if you just don't mind me jumping in here, because I want to connect what you're talking about back to the project in Montgomery, Alabama, because your low-fab philosophy, as you summarized it in the TED Talk, was, as you were sort of getting to there, about hiring locally, sourcing materials regionally, training artisans and laborers when you can. And then I was very intrigued by the fourth part, which was investing in the dignity of the community that the building is intended to serve. So thinking about the lynching memorial in Montgomery, how is that the fourth part there going to be manifest? Because, you know, this is a memorial that isn't without its own controversies in the very city where it's going to be raised.
Yeah, I mean, there's an amazing article about Brian Stevenson's work and this memorial in The New Yorker by Jeffrey Toobin, which came out recently, and encourage people to look at that. I think this fourth issue, how this project could be locally fabricated, just having those set of questions at the outset forced us to think about the process of building differently. And one thing that came about in our conversations as our organizations designed this together was the thought about collecting soil of these places where people were killed and bringing that soil back in individual jars and showcasing that soil as a remnant of the unmarked places in our country which tell a deeper story that we often don't know. And Brian and his team now have been going on a series of soil collection efforts and bringing community members and leaders and descendants together to bring this soil into these jars and bring it back to their headquarters. And it's an amazingly moving and powerful initiative, and very much came out of these conversations about what more could we do, how many hands could we have to make this memorial, how many people could we bring together to build this and change this narrative collectively.
Well, we've just got a couple seconds here left to go, but I am curious. I mean, for a major national monument that addresses, you know, a historical trauma in American life, I can see how the healing philosophy of architecture applies, but can we apply what you've been talking about today to architecture on a smaller scale, on the quotidian scale that most of us encounter?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, architecture is not just the creation of huge heroic buildings. It's the everyday decisions which construct our lives. It's the simple decisions from where you source a material to who builds that building, to how that building functions, to where we walk in our city streets, to the equity of our neighborhoods. These are decisions that are must be designed. And if we ask the harder questions about what else could we do, we could be making more informed and positive decisions about our built space instead of just letting the private sector build it all.
Well, Michael Murphy is founder and executive director of the Boston-based Mass Design Group. He's the architect of the Equal Justice Initiative's Memorial for the Victims of Lynching that will open next year in Montgomery, Alabama. Michael Murphy, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for today. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.